The golden age of radio is on the air. Morehead State Public Radio presents classic old-time radio programs from radio's golden age, the 1930s through the 1950s. On this program of the Golden Age of Radio, a radio play on the CBS Radio Workshop starring John Larkin and Jan Miner. We'll also hear a diamond drama in The Diamond of Caesar Borgia. Stay tuned for the Golden Age of Radio after today's news from NPR on WMKY at 90.3 FM. The Golden Age of Radio. Welcome back to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY at 90.3 FM. Later on today's show, a diamond drama in The Diamond of Caesar Borgia. Right now, a radio play called The Exurbanites, on the CBS Radio Workshop, starring John Larkin and Jan Miner, as WMKY presents The Golden Age of Radio.
The Columbia Broadcasting System and its 217 affiliated stations present the CBS Radio Workshop, radio's distinguished series dedicated to man's imagination, the theater of the mind. Tonight, for the first time on the air, a treatment of A.C. Spatorsky's current and sensational bestseller, a factual yet incredible report of those New Yorkers who try to mix work in the city with country living, and who almost invariably end up behind the eight ball. Narrated by Eric Severide, the CBS Radio Workshop presents The Exurbanites.
This is Eric Severide. Since The Exurbanites became a bestseller, it has been called terrifying, hilarious, penetrating, savage. What you will call it depends entirely on you. But you can be sure of this. Whoever you are, wherever you live, The Exurbanites will strike home to you. Because it's the account of the men who publish your magazines, who hold sway over your radio and television programs, who shape your buying habits in their advertising agencies. Every day of your life, they encourage you to tremendous dreams because they themselves earn their rich living by dreaming tremendously.
That sunshine. Man, where did you find sunshine like that?
You like it, friend?
Well, this is the greatest you've ever painted, Pruitt. The way that sunlight streams through the window, the way it lights the herbs in the window box, the way it touches the girl's hair, the way it dramatizes the can opener.
Call me Van Gogh.
No, I mean it, Pruitt. This is the best artwork I've seen as art director of this agency. It'll sell a million can openers or I go down with the Titanic. Who's the model?
Well, who needs a model for the typical American housewife? Now, she's dream stuff, Fred, just like the sunshine. I painted this on a rainy day that would float the Titanic. Are you ready for the power lawnmower layout?
Let's have her.
Well, here she is. Call me Rembrandt.
This hits me right here. This fellow. The way you've got his teeth clenched on that pipe. The way you've got him bending lovingly over those roses. The age of those gloves on his hands. The beat-up trowel he holds. Oh, that takes me back.
Back to what? Park Avenue?
To my father out in Michigan. That's the way he used to bend over his roses in the twilight. That same twilight that you've caught right here. He had roots, my old man had. Sometimes I wonder why I ever left Michigan.
Well, for the same reasons I left Kansas. $25,000 a year and the choice of the best analysts?
Maybe. But you still couldn't paint like this if you hadn't gone back to the soil.
I beg your pardon.
That place that you've got in Connecticut. Trees, grass, land, roots. You've left New York and got yourself some new roots, Pruitt.
Yeah, I sure have. Setting me back $500 to have them removed from my drywall.
Okay, laugh it up. But I envy you that place, man. Every time I see you lucky fellas head for the country at the end of the day, I remember my father and his roses.
Some ex-urbanites have a highly developed talent for remembering events that have never occurred. But Fred Northshield had a father in Michigan who gardened at twilight. Now, as an advertising agency art director, his dreams were of a vice presidency. But that night in his spacious, comfortable, beautifully decorated Manhattan apartment, the dreams he had helped to dream for millions of American consumers suddenly took over. He was on the verge of becoming an ex-urbanite.
Liz, where's the bottle opener?
Right here, on the wall.
That thing is a bottle opener?
The Magic Handy Open-All. Your agency ran a campaign that sold 2 million in 3 weeks.
Well, how could I see it? There's no sunlight falling on it.
Not right now. No, it's a cloudy night.
Well, this kitchen has no sunlight even when there is sunlight. Every kitchen ought to have sunlight. Sunlight and herbs.
Herbs?
There's not a single darned herb in the window box.
Well, actually, there isn't a window box.
Every kitchen needs a window box with herbs. Just the most important ones, of course. But what you really need is a whole herb garden. You put them just this side of the roses.
I go a little easy on the highballs, dear. It's only 8 o'clock and the bakers are coming over for bridge in a few minutes.
The bakers? Not a root between them.
I beg your pardon?
They've got no roots. We've got no roots.
I see. Well, if it's roots you want and roses, I guess that means we'll have to move to the suburbs.
Not them, Liz. Not the suburbs, house after house, just alike. I mean the real country. Out beyond the suburbs, and an hour from town by train. Grass, lots of it, trees, all you want. Air, all you want of that. How about it, Liz?
Well, I suppose we could look at least.
I knew you'd be for it. Liz, it'll be the greatest thing we ever did.
Thus, to the New Yorker, the country is that land that lies beyond the crowded suburbs, yet remains within 60 minutes' train time of his office. This is a land of exurbia, ex meaning from, and urbia meaning the crowded city and its suburbs. In going to exurbia, he will find it already filled with men like himself, who are gainfully employed in the field of communications, radio, television, commercial art, magazine publishing, public relations, and the theater. In no other field is there more fantastic competition. They deal in ideas, and ideas alone. Tomorrow, someone may have a better idea. Tomorrow, they may suddenly find they are barren of ideas. They will be without a job. The escape to exurbia, then, is their attempt to realize a secret dream that once they are away from the rat race at nightfall, they will ride the superhighway to happiness. And so they begin to look for a place in the country.
Try Bucks County. It's the only real country, Fred. Take a fast train from Penn Station, 1 hour to read a couple of chapters of a good book, and you're in Trenton, ready for real country living across the river in Bucks County. Bucks. Lousy, with beautiful old stone houses ready for a right guy like you to take over. Oscar Hammerstein, Dorothy Parker, Morse Hart, Bud Schoenberg. They went to Bucks. You can raise Black Angus, hens, pigs, pheasant. Or let one of the local men do it for you while you live off the fat of the land. Sleep all night with cows mooing in your ears. Real music.
Bucks County? 1 hour by train and another hour's drive to any kind of land you can buy if your name isn't Rockefeller. Did they tell you about those new steel mills in Bucks? The new Levittown, thousands of homes just like on Long Island? That's country living? It'll be worse than Jersey 5 years from now. If you want old homes, people who really belong to the land, ever been in Rockland County? Quaint, charming, quiet. Try Sneeden's Landing, New City. Look around there. The real artists, the real writers, the real theater people. They're all in Rockland, and they leave you alone.
Alone? Oh, don't be dreary, Fred. Rockland County? Haven't you heard of the Thruway? The new Thruway bridge across the Hudson? It puts the Bronx minutes from Sneeden's Landing. Look, why don't you and Liz spend a weekend with Jerry and me in Chappaqua and take a look around Westchester County? Meet the Reader's Digest crowd. Talk with the writers and the artists around Pound Ridge. Your children will love Westchester. Wonderful schools. Maybe you and Liz should come out some night and go to the PTA with me.
PTA? What are you bucking for, Fred? The job of running their ice cream social? Look, if you want real rich he-man country living, come on out to Long Island's North Shore. Oyster Bay, Manhasset, Sands Point, riding to hounds, yachts lying at anchor, the kind of things F. Scott Fitzgerald wrote about. Ever see that $15 million chateau Marshall Field built there? Vacation place. When they have a wedding, they hire the New York Philharmonic and hide them in the shrubbery to play the wedding march. Wonderful crowd out there in the North Shore.
Wonderful, I'll bet. If you have a chauffeur.
But we're not in that class, Fred. You'll have to ride the Long Island Railroad.
Yeah, I say that's a fate worse than death. Well, I guess we've covered everything but Fairfield County so far, Liz.
Well, Connecticut, here we come.
In considering a move to the exurbs, it is inevitable that the departing New Yorker give strong consideration to Fairfield County, Connecticut. To use a speech habit of its inhabitants, A, it is the most famous, B, it is the fastest growing, C, it is the richest in exurban manifestations.
I suppose you already know a lot of people already living here in Fairfield, Mr. Norshield.
Oh, yes, Mr. Barnum. Several men in our agency live out here.
Now, I'm going to show you folks a beautiful house just put on the market. 9 rooms, 3 baths, and 12 coach lamps.
Coach lamps?
Oh, everybody in Fairfield County has coach lamps, Mrs. Norshield. This place even has 2 besides the outdoor barbecue.
You realize what that means, Liz? We can cook our steaks outdoors every evening.
What kind of heat does this place have, Mr. Barnum?
Heat? 4 fireplaces, 4 beautiful fireplaces, and a whole acre of old trees you can cut up for firewood.
What about a furnace or something?
A furnace? I never thought to ask about that. We're busy out here in Fairfield. I suppose you know we've just about trebled our population the last few years. We're also the richest county in the nation. Even beats Amarillo, Texas.
Oh, you mean something's richer than something in Texas?
That's right, Mrs. Northfield. Why... advertising agency presidents and board chairmen are a dime a dozen. Mere vice presidents and account executives are just foot soldiers. Out here in Fairfield, you'll find the publishers of Life, Woman's Home Companion, 17, Look, Harper's Bazaar, American Weekly, and the president of Time Incorporated. And you'll find that... Did you say something, Mrs. Nosher?
Before we drive much farther, Mr. Barnum, I'd like to ask one thing.
Oh, yes, ma'am.
How much is this house?
50 or 5.
What is that in English?
50,500.
For 9 rooms?
Well, that includes the coach lamps, the barbecue, and a beautiful bluestone terrace.
But no furnace.
Well, now, don't you worry about that furnace until you see the place, Mrs. Norshield. Oh, and I've got to tell you, there's two cobbler's benches go with the place. They say everybody in Fairfield County has a Jaguar, a barbecue, coach lamps, and a cobbler's bench.
Hello?
Oh, Liz, Fred. Listen, it's ours. The old lady met our counter offer at 49, and Barnum wants to see us about arranging the mortgage tomorrow.
Which house is this?
The first one we looked at.
Oh, yes, the one that needs a furnace and a new leg on the second cobbler's bench.
Oh, come off of it. Aren't you excited?
Of course, dear. By the way, do we get a free timetable with a mortgage?
What about the timetable?
Well, Marge Holt used to live in that section, and she says that you'll have to rise and shine at 7 a.m. to dress, have breakfast, and drive to 15 miles to the station to catch the 8:15.
May I share this seat with you?
Why, sure, of course.
Thank you.
Pruitt! My gosh, I didn't even look up when you asked if you could sit down.
One never asks if one can sit down, Fred. One asks if one may share one seat. That's the Officers Club code of our army.
Hmm? What army?
Well, the army you've just joined. The most highly paid, most thoroughly disciplined army in the world. The commuting army. 360,000 commuters descend in New York every working day. Their reveille, the alarm clock. It wakes them at dawn, sends them out into rain, sleet, snow, and the fogs of hangover in their second car.
Yeah, that's right. You know, we hadn't counted on buying a second car, but Liz had to use one car to take the kids to school and back and to do her shopping.
Well, what did you get for parking at the station? Jeep? Jaguar? Station wagon?
What difference does it make?
Well, Fred, it's very important for a man who wants to become a vice president.
Are you kidding?
Well, to men in your position, the car you drive to the station testifies to your sensitivity to what is expected of you. Well, a Jaguar denotes class, yes, but a Jeep presumes that your wife is using the Cadillac to take the kids to school in. That car and your associates on the train can make or break you.
Pruitt, are you drunk this morning? You're talking like a crazy man.
Well, you'll see about the associates. For example, Fred, those two presidents of big agencies who get on at your station... You speak to them, of course.
Well, I nod.
Well, you're learning. A nod, but never speak unless spoken to. You haven't jostled them getting onto the train.
No.
Well, you are learning. Well, one of them may need a vice president 6 months from now. He may start speaking to you on the station platform if you haven't jostled. Until then, merely nod, never speak. An agency president is one of the brass. You're not even a VP yet. You're still one of the foot soldiers.
Now, listen, Pruitt, you know...
Grand Central! Grand Central!
Well, goodbye, Fred.
No, say, wait, I'll walk through the station with you.
I better not. The candidate for vice president is known by the company he keeps. I'm a mere freelance artist dependent on you for work. I could be court-martialed for jostling.
Grand Central! Grand Central!
Fred is a new ex-urbanite, of course, but already he had learned that the rat race from which he has tried to escape now begins the moment his car appears at the station in the morning. It continues as he boards the train, nodding to lesser foot soldiers and to higher brass. It continues as he rides to his working day, and soon it is with him as he starts to leave the office.
On your way home, Fred?
Something you wanted, J.P.?
Oh, no, nothing very much. I've been trying to get to you all day, but I got tied in with the brass at BBD&O and couldn't make it. No, I just want to talk to you about Hubble, that young assistant of yours.
What's wrong, J.P.?
Wrong? Nothing's wrong. You ought to be congratulated for picking such a bright young guy. He was around last night after most of the shop had gone home, and he and Dorfmeyer and I got to polishing some ideas.
Well, why didn't you call me in?
Well, we looked for you, but you'd gone and catch the train already.
Well, I'd have been glad to stay.
Well, don't worry about it, Fred. I can give you all that in a memo, but... You know, it seems to me we need a fresh slant on things. A couple of times recently, with one client or another, I've been left standing with egg on my face. I wonder if we don't have an awful lot of fat around here. We've got spear holders that haven't had their tails kicked in years. You know, if we're going places with the chief's new program for increased billings, we've got to get some new blood, like Hubble. Real hot guys. Young, aggressive. Fact is, I've been thinking of one young fella who's over at McCann right now. I'll sum this up in a memo, and we'll wax our skis together some morning. You better hurry and catch your train.
Hello?
Liz, I won't be home for dinner tonight.
Something wrong, Fred?
We've got to wax our skis.
What are you having, an office party?
Party? It should happen to so nice a guy. I'll make the 8:37.
Yes?
Liz, I'm in Bridgeport.
Bridgeport?
I fell asleep on the 8:37. Now, look, Liz, don't be sore. I'll catch the 10:03 back from Bridgeport, and I'll drive home at once.
Hello.
Liz, please, understand, will you? I got the 10:03 from Bridgeport, honest.
You fell asleep again.
I slept all the way back to New York. I'm going to put up at a hotel for the night. Say goodnight to the kids for me.
Oh, sure. They'll be up for school in a minute or two.
If Liz seems something less than the sweetheart of Sigma Chi, consider the case for her and her sisters of Exurbia. Before marriage, the ex-urbanite wife may have been a Smith graduate clad in the Smith uniform of cashmere sweater and single strand of pearls. She may have been a member of the Dirty Neck and Dirndl set in Greenwich Village. She may have been an actress, a model, or a secretary. But whatever she has been, the ex-urban wife is trying desperately to reestablish a common bond with her husband. She has moved from a small, easily maintained city apartment near stores and people to the exurbs, where she has 8 rooms, is a half mile distant from the nearest adult during the daylight hours, and must drive 5 to 10 miles to the nearest store. It is she who first realizes how tenuous, how limited his dream has become, even when he earns $25,000 a year. How does it happen that they spend at least $2,000 more than they receive?
Federal and New York State income taxes. $5,000 this year, please.
New York State tax? We live in Connecticut.
Well, your husband earns his salary in New York State, ma'am. Doesn't matter where you live. $5,000, please. Thank you, ma'am. Just be glad New York City doesn't tax you commuters. They're considering it, you know.
$2,500 a year, Miss Northfield. And Saturday's all day off, Sunday's all day off, and Thursday afternoon's off.
Oh, that's a lot of money, Hilda.
The Fenimores, they offer me $3,000 to come be their maid.
Well, they have 3 children. We have only 2.
Oh, well, pay her, Liz. I'm not going to have my wife doing all the housework alone.
You got to keep up appearances, too. Yeah, Mr. Northfield. That is $2,500, please. Thank you.
Summer camp for me and Penny. $500 apiece, please. Dancing lessons, me and Penny. $200 apiece, please. Sailing lessons, me. 100. Tennis lessons, Penny. 150. Total, 1450, please. Thank you, Mom.
Tickets, please. Tickets, please. 1 year's commuting, $150, sir. Thank you.
Food?
$3,500.
Insurance?
$1,000. Not enough.
Clothes for wife, self, and family.
$2,150, including 1 sheared beaver.
I hadn't had a new coat in 2 years, and I could have asked for a mink.
New York expenses, lunches, cigarettes, taxis, $2,000.
Plumbing repairs, window repairs, roof repairs, heat, light, all the things our rent used to pay the landlord for doing.
Christmas presents, upkeep on 2 cars, upkeep on grounds around the house.
Hey, Mr. Northfield, you interested in them roses now?
Roses? What roses?
The first day you and the missus moved in, you was talking about coming home and working with your roses. You know, you bought a trowel.
How can I take care of roses with my front yard solid with crabgrass? How can I think about trowels when you're charging me $200 after that last hurricane washed my driveway 1/4 mile down the highway?
Oh, all right.
Fred, no. You can't spend any more. You've already spent a total of $27,500 in a year.
I don't know, Liz. I don't know. Maybe I'll get a vice presidency and a fat increase. Maybe your mother will die and leave us something. We're bound to break even sometime.
Fred's plight, is it deplorable, comical, tragic, incredible? It depends on the state of your own bank account and on your own morality. But in Exurbia, it is not an isolated case. As a general rule, whether he lives in Bucks, Rockland, Westchester, or Fairfield County, or on Long Island, the exurbanite consumer indomitably spends far more than he can earn. An exurban lawyer, himself a counselor on tax and investment matters to other exurbanites, estimates that around the time the high-spending exurbanite makes $60,000 a year, he is beginning to make ends meet. Until then, it's murder. Why doesn't he get out, quit, move to another place, give up the rat race?
I'll tell you why. Anywhere else you live in these United States, it's a matter of keeping up with the Joneses. Where we live, you've got to keep ahead of the Joneses.
It's we who set the styles, mold the fashions, dream the dreams for the rest of the country.
What we do this week will be done a few months from now in Lake Forest, in Santa Barbara, and on Philadelphia's main line. What we decree and talk about in our magazines will be picked up and talked about in Grosse Pointe and Sewickley and Beverly Hills.
A month from now, a million matrons will be trying the 8-day wonder diet dreamed up by an ex-urbanite woman on the 815.
An ex-urbanite woman with a natural size 10 waist.
Several millions more will be quoting the editorial in Life.
Teenagers from coast to coast will try to look like the girl on the cover of Mademoiselle.
The man in the Hathaway shirt.
The man from Schweppes.
The jingle that put the words, "Don't be half safe," to the tune of the Volga Boatman.
They all were dreamed up on the 815 and its counterparts. There isn't an advertising man, a writer, an artist, an actor, photographer. There isn't anybody in the United States with ideas who wouldn't give his shirt to crack New York.
And so it goes. These ex-urbanites come from all over the United States to New York with dreams of writing that great book, painting those great pictures, staging that great play. They find the world of the mass magazine, of radio, television, advertising, needs fresh creative talent for its own ends. The lure of the big money is irresistible. The money increases, the dream changes. Caught in the mesh of symbols which they purvey to the rest of the nation, the country home, the foreign car, the neatly tailored lawn, the power lawnmower, they become ex-urbanites seeking to escape from one rat race only to find themselves in another. A few give up and paint those pictures or write that novel. Some even return to Manhattan where the landlord fixes the leak on the roof. The rest remain, their dreams limited by money, train schedules, and sheer physical fatigue. Yet through all this, as you see him at home with his family, at the office, with his companions on the train, the ex-urbanite is witty, amusing, clever, entertaining. A man who is fun to be with and rewarding to talk to. Never vanquished, he now has a new secret dream of giving it all up to run a health resort for other broken-down ex-urbanites. To own a country hotel or an antique business, or actually to farm his land and make it pay. Exurbia is full of these secret dreams. Meanwhile, he does the best he can at the difficult and exciting job of living. And the job he does is, under the circumstances, often remarkably good.
You have been listening to The Exurbanites, a special treatment of A.C. Spektorsky's report on New Yorkers in the communications field. Prepared by Charles S. Monroe, narrated by Eric Severide, and directed by Paul Roberts. The music was composed by Ben Ludlow and conducted by Alfredo Antonini. Featured in the cast were John Larkin as Fred, Jan Miner as Liz, and Joe Helgeson as Pruitt. This is Bob Height inviting you to listen to the CBS Radio Workshop next Friday for The Enormous Radio by John Cheever. The CBS Radio Workshop is produced in New York by Paul Roberts. Stay tuned for 5 minutes of the latest CBS News. And remember, America listens most to the CBS Radio Workshop.
You are listening to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY and a radio play called The Exurbanites on the CBS Radio Workshop. Stay tuned for more classic old-time radio from the 1930s through the 1950s. When the Golden Age of Radio continues on Morehead State Public Radio, WMKY at 90.3 FM. Welcome back to the Golden Age of Radio on WMKY at 90.3 FM. In a moment, a diamond drama and the Diamond of Caesar Borgia. Right after we hear about the Lady in the Lake on Incredible But True, as WMKY presents the Golden Age of Radio.
Contrary to popular belief and to the conceptions of the writers of horror stories, strange and mysterious events do not require strange and mysterious settings. One of the most remarkable incidents in all the annals of the incredible took place on the teeming streets of New York City. It was there that the girl named Dorothy Arnold was last seen in human form.
Missing persons have long been a daily phenomenon in this largest city in the world. Consequently, the chief of the Missing Persons Bureau of New York City looked upon it as a matter of routine when on December 13th, 1910, a middle-aged man in a state of great agitation came bustling into the room.
You people have got to help me find her. She's gone, disappeared. I want you to start looking for her this very minute.
That might be easier if we knew who she is.
It's my ward. It's Dorothy Arnold.
How long has she been missing?
Almost 24 hours. She came to my office yesterday morning. When she left, I walked up Fifth Avenue a few blocks with her. We separated at 79th Street.
Which way did she go?
She went into the park. She always came home for dinner, but she didn't show up. I waited up for her all night, but there was no sign of her.
Within a half hour, the elaborate police machinery had gone into motion. In every section of the city, it was known that Dorothy Arnold, aged 20, 5 feet 5 inches tall, blue eyes, light blonde hair, was missing. The hospital lists were scrutinized. The recent arrivals at the municipal morgues were examined closely. Shadowy figures who were well known to the police were rounded up and questioned. The following morning, the chief of the missing persons department was ready to report to Robert Decker.
We haven't found a single clue so far, Mr. Decker. But I wouldn't be too discouraged if I were you. It's been our experience that when girls disappear the way your ward disappears, it's usually because they want to.
You mean you think Dorothy ran away?
She doubtless had at least one male friend who wouldn't have been averse to the idea, didn't she?
The only man she cared about, the only man she ever paid the slightest attention to, happens to be in Italy at the moment. When she came to my office, she was planning a tea for some of her former classmates, about 60 of them. It was to be held in my home next Thursday, the 17th. We talked about it all the way up Fifth Avenue, and Dorothy was tremendously pleased and excited about the whole thing. When she left me there at the 79th Street entrance to the park, she was well and happy. And then something happened to her.
From that day until this, Dorothy Arnold has never been seen again. All this, one may say, is scarcely remarkable. But the case of Dorothy Arnold becomes remarkable when one considers an item that was printed in the pages of the New York Sun on December 13th, the day her disappearance was reported.
Scientists were baffled by an unprecedented occurrence in Central Park this morning. There has never been a swan on the park lake before, but one appeared there today. The swan, a full-grown and particularly beautiful specimen, was first observed on that portion of the lake which borders the 79th Street entrance.
No, Dorothy Arnold's disappearance has never been explained, nor has anyone ever been able to explain the presence of the swan on the lake in Central Park. All that can be said is that the two events occurred at the same time and in the same place. This is a fact which leads one to certain inescapable and astonishing conclusions. A fact incredible but true.
Today, in a museum in Europe, is a ring shaped like a lion's claw clasping a small rough diamond. During the Middle Ages, this strange ring was known as the Ring of Death, and it belonged to... But wait. It is the year 1500. The Duke of Urbino has secretly conspired with other nobles in a plot to overthrow the powerful and treacherous Caesar Borgia. All is ready, when suddenly, Borgia visits the home of one of the conspirators. That night, the conspirator mysteriously dies, and his wife, shocked and grief-stricken, flees to the care of her sister, who is the wife of the Duke of Urbino. Listen, the Duke is talking with his wife.
Gian's death makes us certain that someone discovered his part in the plot, but we dare not act until we know how much or how little is suspected. Ah, if only Maria could remember.
Oh, Guido, she tried so hard. The shock must have been terrible. She can't even remember who was there at the time.
After a little while, perhaps in a day or two, it will all come back to her. We've got to know Elisabetta. Our plans for the future depend on it.
You should hear her. Guido, did you ever see a ring like a lion's claw holding a diamond?
No. No, why?
Maria keeps talking about it. She knows she's seen it somewhere, and it seems to haunt her memory.
Well, she's likely to talk about anything as upset as she is.
No, Guido. This ring seems to have some meaning, so strong that she can't get her mind away from it.
Here's Joseph.
A message, senor.
Thank you. You needn't wait.
Guido, What's the matter? What's happened? Guido, answer me.
Caesar Borgia is coming to pay us a little visit.
Caesar Borgia? Coming here?
Yes. Yes, dear. Any moment now. Maria, do you know any reason why we should fear Caesar Borgia?
I don't know.
Then why did you start when I said his name?
It's all so confusing. If I could only remember, if I could... Lisabetta, have you ever seen a ring like a lion's claw clutching a diamond?
No, dear, I've told you I haven't.
I have. I know. Oh, if I could just...
Lisabetta?
Yes?
Come, dear. Our guest is now at the gate.
Oh, I won't be long, Maria. Try to rest now.
Did you tell her?
Yes.
Did she say anything that might...
No, but when I said his name, she went pale and began to tremble. Oh, Guido, I'm sure our suspicions are justified.
As long as Caesar Borgia is here, my life is in danger. I've sent word to the Duke of Pesaro, and he and the Duke of Milan will have time to organize. Elisabetta, we shall receive Caesar Borgia as our guest.
Oh, I don't want to meet him.
You wait here by the door. I'll meet him on the stairs. Hurry, he's coming now.
Welcome to Urbino. Welcome, Generalissimo Borgia.
Oh, this is kind of you, Signor.
Not at all, my lord. I am honored.
Not everyone in Italy considers it an honor. Oh, this is the Duchess?
Caesar Borgia, my wife, Elisabetta, Duchess of Urbino.
You are very kind to welcome me, my lady.
My lord, it is a great honor to welcome in my home one of such high distinction.
Your hospitality is most generous.
Oh.
Why, Signora, what's the matter?
Oh, nothing. Just a sharp pain here in my side. It's not unusual. I'm sorry to have startled you.
A pain? Most regrettable.
My lord, if you are weary and wish to go to your rooms, Joseph will show you the way.
Thank you. We have had a long ride. I'll be glad to rest.
Joseph, take the Generalissimo to his rooms.
Yes, Signor.
We shall dine within the hour, if that will be convenient for you.
You very well, thank you. I shall be ready.
Why did you gasp like that?
Oh, Guido, did you see Caesar Borgia's hand?
Why, yes, of course.
Then didn't you notice? Didn't you see it?
What do you mean, Elisabetta?
The ring, Guido. The ring with the lion's claw holding a diamond.
Have you told her about the ring?
Not yet.
Is she strong enough to stand a possible shock?
Why, she's much better, Guido. What do you mean?
I want to talk to her. Oh, if she could only remember what happened that night Jeanne was murdered.
Guido, what has happened?
Caesar Borgia suspects more than I thought.
Oh, what's he going to do?
And that, my dear, Maria alone can tell us.
You mean?
Listen, I've received word that the Dukes of Pesaro and Milan will arrive here late tonight. But if Caesar should also hear of it...
He may do the same to you.
If he hears of the approaching army, he dare not stay, for he'll be more than outnumbered. And if he finds he has to leave, he'll... Well, no one knows just what killed Jeanne.
Oh, Guido, isn't there something we can do?
I'm not sure that Caesar knows everything, and yet...
Yes?
Oh,
yes?
If I only knew what to expect, what to avoid. But we can only wait and see.
Would you mind sitting in here just a moment, dear? Guido wants to ask you some questions.
Maria, by any chance did Caesar Borgia come to your house just before Jeanne died?
You see how she starts when you say his name?
Why, I don't remember, Guido. He used to come, that is, some time before, and seemed quite friendly.
Then why do you start when I speak of him?
Oh, it's all so hazy. The ring, too. If I could just...
Whose ring was it, Maria?
I can't remember that either.
Was it Caesar Borgia's ring?
I don't know.
Would you know the ring if you saw it?
Yes. Yes. I think I would. It might all come back to me.
Then listen. Caesar Borgia wears a ring exactly as you describe. Tonight at dinner, you hide behind the heavy curtains of the window. Watch, and perhaps you will remember.
Guido, it makes me nervous to watch him sitting there, smiling and talking and twisting that ring on his finger.
Hush. Ah, someone's coming. No. No, it's a message for Caesar. Oh, I feared this.
Oh, I don't care if he does escape, as long as you are safe. It's maddening waiting for something to happen.
Hush. He's excusing himself.
Why, my lord, I hope you haven't received bad news.
Oh, not at all. Good news, in fact.
I'm glad to hear it.
I'm not so sure that you are, for I'm leaving Urbino at once.
Oh, leaving?
This message confirms my suspicions. The Dukes of Milan and Pizarro will be here in Urbino within an hour. I must leave, or else I am trapped. It was an excellent idea, my friend, but does not succeed.
And I'm sorry for that, Caesar Borgia.
I would sack your palace and lay waste your city. But I must go.
Perhaps, my lord, we shall meet on the battlefield.
I doubt it very much. Well, I must go and give orders for our departure. And then I wish to speak to you if it will be convenient.
As you wish. I shall be here.
I'll not be long.
Guido, what's he going to do? Oh, Guido, I...
Giovanni, Emilia, would you all mind retiring to the drawing room?
Oh, Guido, what did he mean?
Elisabetta, that's who it was. He did it.
But how? How did he do it?
The ring. Caesar's ring.
Wait. I hear him coming. Hide back of the curtains again.
But Guido, you don't know.
Let us stay there. We'll have to chance it.
Well, Signor, I must be on my way. And I wish to thank you, Signora, for your most generous hospitality. Oh, you seem relieved, Signora, that I am leaving.
I am sorry, Caesar Borgia, that you have made it necessary for me to feel that relief.
Well, surely, Signora, you didn't suspect a guest of any possible treachery.
I do not know, my lord.
Well, it's the fortunes of war. And who can tell from one day to the next? But I must go. A few moments more and all would be lost. Well, Signor... You said that we should meet on the battlefield. Are you sure of that?
I am, Caesar Borgia.
And how sure, I wonder? Shall we clasp hands and make it a wager?
I am more than willing, Excellency, to make that wager with you.
Yeah, Duke of Urbino. It's a wager that you are going to lose. Your hand, Signor.
Ah!
Joe, what's that?
Stop, Guido! Don't touch it!
Maria, what's wrong with it? Why?
The ring! The ring, Guido! It's poisoned. Don't shake his hand. The other diamond's turned inside. Oh, don't touch it.
How did she know? How did you? The wife of Gian Galeazzo. Ah, I had forgotten she was your sister, Signora.
Then you did, Caesar Borgia. You did kill Gian.
And would have killed you, Signor, but for this woman. Well, it's late. Adieu, Signor. You win your wager. We shall someday meet on the battlefield.
And that was the last time on record that Caesar Borgia attempted to use his poisoned ring, the diamond of which, while scratching the palm of his enemy, injected a deadly poison from a tiny cavity. In the year 1505, 5 years later, Caesar Borgia was defeated and captured in battle.
Me came by my side. butterflies round my rocking chair. Judgment Day is here. Chained to my rocking chair. Old rocking chair's got me.
Golden Age of Radio on WMKY with Mildred Bailey and Rockin' Chair from 1937. We also heard The Diamond of Caesar Borgia, first broadcast on radio on April 15, 1945, and The Lady and the Lake on Incredible But True. This has been the Golden Age of Radio, classic old-time radio programs from the 1930s through the 1950s. Material for this program provided by the Internet Archive, an online nonprofit library of books, movies, music, and old-time radio shows, on the web at archive.org. Tune in again for the Golden Age of Radio next week at this same time and channel on WMKY at 90.3 FM and online at wmky.org.